ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays.
We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is.
It's serious reporting on global events. Plus you're invited for a daily radio coffee table chat with me, Geraldine Doogue.
And with me, Hamish McDonald. And in 2026, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Together we'll explore the global forces reshaping our world in mostly calm conversation.
Calm, Geraldine. Global roaming. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
40 years ago, the Challenger space shuttle exploded 73 seconds after launch over the skies of Cape Canaveral in Florida.
We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
All seven of the crew were killed, including Krista McAuliffe, who was set to become the first teacher to ever fly to space. It was an unprecedented disaster for NASA, America's space agency.
We've never lost an astronaut in flight. We've never had a tragedy like this.
Then, nearly two decades later, another disaster for NASA. This time, it was the space shuttle Columbia. It broke apart re-entering Earth's atmosphere after 16 days in space, killing another seven astronauts.
Their families shattered. The space program has been dealt a terrible blow.
In the wake of those twin mishaps almost 20 years apart, there was a search for what had gone wrong. Beyond the mechanical failures of each incident, could the culture of an organization like NASA and the natural, sometimes fallible way in which humans think go some way to explaining what had happened?
You are not aware of it happening, and that is where the big danger of normalization of deviance really lies.
Every single step is in itself sensible, defensible, can be made to make sense, and probably even invisible to most people who work inside the system.
And could similar patterns explain disasters across different industries, from sinking cruise ships to train derailments?
The captain of the stricken Italian cruise ship, the Costa Concordia, says the rock that ripped the hull of his ship wasn't on maritime charts.
A safety feature common on trains across Australia has been dismissed by a train crash inquiry in New South Wales as being basically ineffective.
From ABC Radio National, this is All in the Mind with me, Sana Qadar. Today, a look at how disasters can happen and what it all has to do with the way that humans think. All in the Mind senior producer James Bullen is in the studio for this one. Hi, James.
Hi, Sana.
So what actually happened to Challenger and Columbia? Like, what actually caused these disasters on the day?
So for Challenger, it was the O-rings. These were rubber rings which connected different parts of the shuttle together. And in the cold temperatures at launch, it meant that they didn't work as expected and they split the shuttle apart those 73 seconds after it took off.
God.
And then in Columbia, it was a foam strike. So foam fell off the fuel tank of the shuttle as it launched and hit the wing. It went up to space, everything was fine, except 16 days later when it came back.
Mm.
The damage to the wing meant that heat in re-entry destroyed the shuttle and killed the crew.
Yeah, I remember that disaster. I mean, I was a teenager back when that happened, and it was horrifying to watch.
Yeah, just shocking seeing it split apart as it kind of crossed the sky. Mm. Those foam strikes and those O-ring issues, they were both known by NASA, by management, by engineers for years prior to these disasters.
Wow.
And that is kind of the core of this whole story, this idea of normalization of deviance.
That's a really captivating title, normalization of deviance.
It is a really captivating title. And it's an idea that we've been working on in another series from ABC Radio National called The Challenger Legacy. That's with the reporting of Fiona Pepper and Dr. Carl as well. The core idea of normalization of deviance was coined by an American sociologist, Diane Vaughan, in the 90s during her own analysis of the Challenger disaster. Others have been working on it since.
So normalization of deviance is effectively a concept that encapsulates, let's say, the process of how certain behaviors or actions that were once considered wrong or devious in some way gradually become accepted as part of the norm of an organization or of a system. And this acceptance is primarily driven by production pressures, let's say, or pressures to optimize certain operations in combination with the fact that previous engagements in such behaviors did not lead to significant perceived negative events or consequences.
This is Dr. Nate Sedlar. He's a lecturer in psychology at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland and a researcher into normalization of deviance.
In the context of Space Shuttle Challenger, we had several years prior to the mission, the Challenger mission, where the erosion of the O-rings were noted. However, they did not negatively impact on the success of the mission. Therefore, there was a new norm established that the seriousness of O-ring erosion was no longer considered a major deviation. It was not considered a serious enough cause to effectively cancel the mission.
Nate says normalization of deviance can happen in any industry, but the places where it's perhaps more likely and where the consequences can be catastrophic are those high-risk, complex industries where people's lives are at stake. Think spaceflight, aviation, healthcare.
Healthcare is one of the sectors that has really embraced specifically the concept of normalization of deviance as of late, because it is such an intricate, complex system with so many rules and procedures that need to be followed, with the consequences of something going wrong being potentially deadly.
So the question I'm left with after hearing that is, aren't those rules and those procedures in place specifically to prevent things from going wrong?
They are, but we don't always follow the rules, right? And it's just kind of the way we function. We seek efficiencies, we maybe find shortcuts, and this normalization is often motivated by people wanting to do the right thing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So going back to that healthcare example,
a doctor would have to go through a list of various kind of steps in order to make a determination or to basically engage in a certain procedure. However, the doctor is very confident that they do not need to do all of those steps and that they can actually resolve this issue with this patient much quicker by essentially skipping those steps. And that is something that can become somewhat normalized. Same goes, for example, with, let's say, hygiene elements of washing your hands every single time after certain procedure or even just meeting with a patient. Those kind of things might be considered overbearing and in some cases might become impossible if the cleaning station is inoperable, is not well stocked, or whatever that causes the people to, again, deviate from that procedure on one occasion.
Then over time, people start to think,
it was okay when I did it then, nothing bad happened, and I was actually able to save time by doing that. Again, these are very minor things that can happen, and it is one of those things where it's difficult to necessarily say they are not engaged in any malicious manner. This is not something that doctors would do and go, I want to cause any harm to anyone. It is something that is engaged in because of the circumstances that they are in and because they ultimately wish to optimize what they're doing.
Okay, so this is precisely why, you know, in broadcasting we have a saying, this is not brain surgery. And I am so grateful for that because when stuff goes wrong in our jobs, it's generally okay. Nobody's going to die. But I can totally see how this kind of thinking would seep in to people and actually have a real effect on people's lives.
Yeah. Yeah. When lives are on the line, that's when this normalization of deviance starts to become a really big problem.
But it is interesting to realize that, you know, it can be because they're not trying to do the wrong thing. They're trying to actually do the right thing. They're trying to see more patients. They're treating people more quickly and making judgment calls.
Yeah, 100%. And another area that really surprised me that Nate's talked about was firefighters.
That cultural aspect of we are here to save people, we want to prioritize that as much as possible, it allows for greater justification of deviating from procedures that you believe are actually impeding you in some way. A lot of the times, the deviations that they engage in, or at least that the paper that we reviewed talked about, was the fact that firefighters did not wear the required personal safety equipment that they are meant to. And the rationale that the firefighters gave for deviating from that was that equipment was too heavy and prevented them from being able to save people within the building. Obviously, the counterargument to that from chiefs and safety experts that designed the personal safety equipment is, but you are more likely to injure yourself, to basically get trapped yourself, so you should be wearing that equipment. However, that argument only goes so far when the personal experience of the firefighter is, it makes me slower, I feel more in danger, and I feel helpless, I am not able to help this person. I know from experience that if I do not wear that equipment, I feel like I can save more people.
That is fascinating. This is not where I thought a conversation about normalization of deviance would take us.
Yeah, the unexpected areas where it crops up and how it kind of links to social or cultural kind of identities at work, like firefighters,
and
healthcare.
Values, like how values influence what goes wrong sometimes.
Yes, yes, definitely. Yeah. And there are kind of other factors at play as well, I suppose. There's the incentives that a business or an organization kind of sets up.
Those are the more obvious ones you would think of.
Yeah, it's kind of that faster, better, cheaper, want it all. Yeah. But there is another phenomenon that does come into play here, and it's called local rationality.
Local rationality is the idea that what people do makes sense to them at the time, given their goals, given their knowledge, and given their focus of attention.
Sydney Decker is a professor at Griffith University in the School of Humanities, Languages, and Social Sciences. His background is in psychology, and he's published several books looking at risk, safety, and complex systems.
People don't come to work to do a bad job, and that's not just NASA engineers, that's anybody, you know, nurse in a hospital. People, we have to assume that people don't come to work to do a bad job. And so that's another way of saying local rationality. Now, why these decisions are locally rational is, one, because they solve a real problem, right? We can keep flying. They work against the background that would otherwise generate anxiety. Oh, my word, what do we do with the schedule pressures, this and that? We're supposed to go up. This satellite needs to get up, right? And customers paying for this thing or whatever it may be. And so not only does it solve a real problem, but it deals with anxieties and other constraints that surround a system like this. What's interesting is that when it comes back, it appears successful. And so not only is it local rationality for that decision, but it's a local rationality that then feeds into the rationalization of the next decision.
One concept Sydney has researched and written a book about is something he calls drift into failure. It shares some similarities with normalization of deviance and can also help us understand how failures occur in complex systems. Like Nate's, Sydney sees this drift as a fundamental, inevitable part of how humans operate.
There is something fundamental to drift and adaptation in human behavior and the way we relate to the world as it is dynamic and changes around us. If we wouldn't do that, we would have no adaptive advantage and we would have died out a very long time ago. So the idea of drifting has everything to do with the idea of getting used to things. And people are, in fact, very good at that. They're very good at normalizing that which was slightly abnormal yesterday and going, oh, okay, well, yeah, that's probably normal. And in fact, probably stop asking questions about it. So yes, it is fundamental to human nature to even survive in a dynamic world, whether it's looking after patients on a hospital ward, whether it is pumping oil out of deep water, whether it's flying space shuttles or even flying jetliners, right? And so, and the reason for that, James, is that as Jens Rasmussen, one other theoretician in this space, so beautifully said, you know, we're always adrift. We're not only adrift toward a safety boundary, but we're adrift in this space that is bounded on three sides. And so one is the safety boundary. And if you go across that, you have an accident and the system fails. But there's two other ways, says Jens, in which that system can fail. And you're bouncing around this envelope all the time. So the two other ways are a workload boundary. And the third one is a financial boundary. And so you can make it really, 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 really safe. But then you're probably paying so much that you're going to fail that way. Or you're going to make it really, really, really safe and say, before we do surgery, we have 50,000 checklists that we go through to make sure absolutely sure. Well, right? I mean, ambulance ramping, patient waiting lists. I mean, the system will fail because of the workload that it creates for itself, right? So we're always adrift by having to manage and thus sacrifice one of these things against another. And so Yes, I think it is very safe to say that there is no human system that works in a complex dynamic world that is not somehow adrift all the time.
Nate Sedlar has reviewed the common factors that cause normalization of deviance. Production pressure is the key one. Unrelenting pressure driving people in an organization towards some goal, perhaps having to let safety fall by the way to reach it. Leadership also plays a role. Then there are the cognitive biases we humans all tend to experience, like availability bias and our use of heuristics.
It's availability bias, where the past events that we have observed, that we know about, if we only know about events where someone has engaged in that behavior, or we ourselves have engaged in that behavior, and they have all led to a positive outcome, where we might have even been praised for optimizing that behavior, for getting more work done on that day because we cut corners, well, and nothing bad happened as a result of it, then we're more likely to engage in it because, well, our biased perception of it was the result of this behavior is positive, so we are more likely to repeat it.
Plus, we don't like spending our precious cognitive resources on constantly evaluating decisions. That's just human.
We often rely on set rules or just basically do what we have always done in the past. Because we are ultimately cognitive misers. We want to preserve as much cognitive energy as possible because attending to every decision that we make in our day-to-day life to the full extent of analyzing all the benefits and all of the costs or the potential risks of doing that decision, that would be exhausting. And we do not have that cognitive energy to be able to do that. So as a result of that, we basically use heuristics. We use these kind of shortcuts. And the easiest one is do what we have done before. Do what has worked in the past. We are more likely to simply repeat what we have done before because engaging in any kind of additional assessment of that decision, we do not see any reason for it unless the context changes, unless there is something that kind of stops us in our track and we go, let's reassess this. Then that engagement in that kind of deeper thought processes can occur. And even with the limited knowledge, we might be able to reassess what we are doing.
From ABC Radio National, you're listening to All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar. Senior producer James Bullen has today's episode, and at the top of this episode, we heard about the Challenger disaster, which is the space shuttle that exploded after launch back in 1986. James, how well does normalization of deviance explain what happened there?
It is one explanation for sure, in that they knew that these O-rings were a problem. It didn't cause any immediate damage in kind of the shuttles that launched before Challenger in 86. And so they kind of waved it away and thought it wasn't actually an issue when it definitely was. But some people don't like that explanation for the disaster.
All right.
They push back against it because they see it as excusing personal responsibility or the kind of on-the-ground decisions that individuals made
right
in the lead-up to the launch.
Okay, so for people who aren't familiar with the story of Challenger, what were some of those decisions?
So the night before the launch, engineers who had been involved in making the shuttle met with NASA and expressed some of these worries, these concerns about the O-rings. But because they were on a schedule, because there were budget pressures, because they wanted to prove that this would be a successful space program, they went ahead with the launch anyway.
So there were significant organizational reasons leading to this, not just a subtle normalization of deviance over time, which I suppose also was caused by these organizational pressures.
Yeah, it's a bit of a snake eating its head type situation. Yeah, but definitely there were massive organizational, structural kind of pressures leading up to these decisions.
And so are there other examples of disasters that are seen to have been caused by normalization of deviance?
Yeah, there's quite a few. In the literature, one that gets analysed is the Costa Concordia. This was that Italian cruise ship, the luxury cruise ship that ran aground off the coast of Italy, capsized, 32 people died. The normalization of deviance angle there is that they had kind of normalized this routine of coming close to the coastline and saluting people on the coastline to kind of show off the cruise liner, and that's when they ran into the rocks.
The captain had been performing a sail past salute of Italy's Giglio Island and went too close. The ship lost all power and tilted on its side.
Another one is this Northwick Park drug trial. So
I haven't heard of this.
This was in the UK. It was six men who were in a clinical trial. They all got dosed with this experimental drug and then had a kind of massive adverse reaction to it. They were hospitalized. One of them lost his fingers and toes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, shocking. And they worked out after the events that they should never have been dosing everyone at the same time with this experimental drug. Six people at once.
They are suffering from major organ failure.
Six men remain seriously ill in hospital after taking part.
The original protocol had suggested that they should just do one at a time. And it makes way more sense to just do one, see what happens, then come to the next. Yeah. But for perhaps budget reasons, perhaps time reasons, they started doing it like this, and it led to this pretty catastrophic result.
All right, so we've heard how these kinds of errors can arise and some of the cognitive quirks and system complexities that allow them. How then do you stop them from happening?
Yeah, Sydney and Nates have some ideas about that.
What successful systems do is they actually stay uneasy about their success because failure happens because you are successful. And I think this is a key lesson of accidents that are traceable to drift into failure.
That's Professor Sydney Decker from Griffith University again.
They failed because they were successful. They didn't fail because they were already breaking down very visibly and had incidents and accidents and things all over the place. No, no, no. They were successful. Deepwater Horizon, a whole year with no incidents or injuries whatsoever, right? Which is probably not true, but, you know, at least they were telling themselves that. Look at us being so successful, right? And then you blow stuff up and kill a lot of people and create the biggest oil spill in the history of humanity. And so, so that really is the first one. Stay uneasy about your success. When you are in a period when apparently nothing goes wrong, that's not proof that things are safe.
That doesn't mean you don't recognize success, but be a little skeptical of it, Sydney says.
Celebrate it for all I care, right? Go, oh, hey, aren't we great? Look at us go. Sure. But then ask some questions. What is it that we didn't do? What have we sacrificed to get here? Because we can't be, you know, faster, better, and cheaper all at the same time. Something will have to give. And so what gave? What did we not do, right?
Professor Sydney Decker says another thing organizations that avoid a drift into failure do is listen to the intuition of their people.
They listen to not just data, they listen to discomfort. They feel their gut and they go, it doesn't really feel good. I'm not liking this approach into this airport. I'm not liking how this jet is looking, or right? Which is very difficult to then bring back to the boss and say, boss, I got some bad news. What do you mean? Well, we're not going to do this mission because it doesn't feel good. You don't make friends doing that, right?
It seems counterintuitive or almost ascientific not to follow the data. So what supports following discomfort in this way?
You could call it sort of the parameterization problem, that if you want to run all of your decisions of what to do on a system based on data that you somehow measure, it means, first of all, that you know what you are out to measure and why you want to measure it, and that you, in fact, have a way to measure it, that you can stick a probe into something or right, and then measure whatever it is that you need to measure, the pressure, you know, some velocity, some derivative, some whatever it may be. What we see in socio-technical systems, take a midwife. Right, we're studying this, and all of a sudden we're in a situation where the midwife announces rather loudly, and I mean, and they're the kind of nurses that are, at some point when they say that something needs to happen, it's not a negotiation, right? It's not a proposition for, oh, let's kick that around the room a little bit, right? No, this needs to happen, and all of a sudden she says, this baby needs to get out now. And we're all scrambling around looking at the data, going, what do you mean? Maybe heart rate looks fine, right?
That example is really fascinating because it brings me back to an episode we did of All in the Mind a couple of years ago now. It was on this exact topic. It was about gut instinct. And the researchers we spoke to in that episode said that when someone has, you know, a lot of experience and expertise in an area, their intuition and their experience may pick up on things that the data isn't picking up on.
Yeah, there really seems to be something about intuition.
and the literature is picking up on this more and more, that adds a whole bunch of additional parameters and probably combinations of parameters to this panoply of data that we already collect from these systems and to base our decisions on. So yes, there is definitely support in the literature, James, that suggests that we should be acutely aware of intuition steering people to places where they go, what's that smell? I'm not sure. I haven't seen that yet. Right? And because you may be in a situation where that isn't picked up by whatever data trace the system is capable of producing for you.
We mentioned earlier that some people don't like the idea of normalization of deviance. They see it as absolving people of personal responsibility, where sometimes it can look like the choices of individuals lead to disaster.
Yes, and that is a concern that we absolutely wish to address. It is not necessarily about letting anyone off the hook. It is about, however, about recognizing the situation that people are put under. What the aim of any accident investigation ultimately is to prevent the disaster from occurring again in the future. Not to lay blame, not to assign who was at fault or to punish anyone within such a context, but how do we make sure that this does not happen again in the future? Whether someone was qualified to be in the position that they are in can be considered part of that system. It is considered an aspect of, was the person trained well enough? Were they aware? Were they able to take on the responsibility that was afforded to them?
Sydney Decker broadly agrees.
The questions that are much more oriented toward learning are the ones that say, who's impacted by this? Who's impacted by this event? And you'll find immediately that whoever signed off on it is pretty impacted. I can tell you that from experience with lots of second victims in all kinds of industries. The second question is, what do they need? Everybody who's impacted, what do they need? Right? Very compassionate question. What do you need in order to deal with the impact that has been caused to you? And then the third question is, whose obligation is it to start meeting that need? Well, maybe you come back to the person who signed it off. Yeah, but maybe not. Maybe there's all kinds of other people who carry the obligation to start meeting that need. What it does, James, is it flips the accountability question from a backward-looking one that says, you know, okay, well, let's trace back and use all of our hindsight to find exactly who signed off what, where, when, and thereby violated this, that, or the other thing, and we're going to punish that person for that thing in the past. Instead, it says, no, accountability is forward-looking. It lies in the future. It asks questions about who's going to do what now based on what we've learned, and how are we going to know that that's going to happen? And to make accountability about what needs to happen now instead of accountability about what happened yesterday.
Sydney says those second victims, the ones left behind in a disaster, are people we can learn from too.
Second victims are those who have a role in running that system, flying the airplane, being at the bedside in a hospital, or for that matter, being an engineer involved in the launching space shuttle Challenger. Those second victims have a very particular kind of suffering that we see, James. What they have is feelings of guilt, remorse, feelings of responsibility, but also an authority-responsibility mismatch where they feel responsibility but weren't given the authority to really act on it. And so, again, second victims are an incredible source of information about the inside and indeed the intuitions of how these systems work and fail.
That was Professor Sydney Decker from Griffith University. You also heard from Dr. Nate Sedlar from the University of Aberdeen. This episode from All in the Mind was from senior producer James Bullen, with additional reporting and production from Fiona Pepper. Thanks to producer Rose Kerr and sound engineer Roy Huberman. I'm Sana Kadar, and just before I go, if you want to hear more about the Challenger and Columbia disasters, the behind-the-scenes story of the engineers who tried to stop these disasters from happening, you should head over to our sister podcast, Science Friction. They have a series running right now called The Challenger Legacy with Dr. Carl and Fiona Pepper, and it tells this story. Here's a little snippet for you.
This is AM. Good morning. I'm Red Harrison. And as we go to air, NASA is about to hold a news conference on what is tragically America's worst disaster in space.
On January 28th, 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded in the sky, killing all seven crew on board. It was an unthinkable occurrence.
We've never lost an astronaut in flight. We've never had a tragedy like this.
I remember going into my mum's place and then seeing it on her TV while we were having breakfast. Oh my God.
I can still remember exactly how utterly incomprehensible I found it that something like that had happened.
We just thought it was taking off into space and then we couldn't believe it, it had exploded.
I ran outside as fast as I could and I looked up in the sky and I saw a very strange contrail.
Like it was just shocking.
Millions of people all around the world were closely watching this launch because this was the first time that a civilian had ever been sent to space. And it wasn't just any civilian, it was a teacher selected to inspire young people, to teach them about space.
Among those glued to the television screens to watch today's liftoff were Mrs. McCullough's pupils at the high school in the small New England town of Concord, where she taught. Their cheers turned to tears as the tragedy unfolded before their eyes.
For those who were closely involved, those on the inside, even 40 years, that's four decades later, the launch is still vivid. It's like it was yesterday.
He just put his hands down in his face and he just started crying. He sobbed.
I just felt that we were the cause.
There was stunned silence and I knew I had to say something. The thing I chose to say was...
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction. We have no downlink.
I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Carl Krushelnitsky, a.k.a. Dr. Carl. I was a very baby Dr. Carl back then. Taxi driver, physicist, engineer, trainee, doctor, and a wannabe astronaut. Absolutely obsessed with everything to do with the space shuttle program. I remember what happened to the Challenger, but I'm also pretty sure I don't have every single detail correct.
And I'm too young to remember it, but I've gone down the rabbit hole reporting this story, and I can't believe some of the details of what I've learned.
Together, Fee and I want to tell you the story of Challenger.
The story of what went wrong and what happened next.
In the 40 years since the accident happened, it's hard for anyone who wasn't around before 1986 to understand exactly how inconceivable it seemed that NASA could fall victim to a catastrophe of this scale.
He totally failed to elevate that issue. That to me is almost criminal negligence.
My biggest regret in the whole episode, I wish I'd have said that there's a dissenting opinion here.
But then close to two decades after the Challenger disaster, another tragedy unfolds at NASA, killing another seven crew.
America in shock as the space shuttle disintegrates minutes before landing. A 16-day mission ends in disaster. Seven astronauts are dead.
It's a story about NASA, about risk, complacency, and ambition.
When you dig deep enough, there's no question that the organizational culture was implicated in both the Columbia and Challenger mishaps.
We know they made mistakes, bad mistakes. People have to live with that for the rest of their lives.
As you explore these different accidents, there are so many of these lessons that come out, but they keep repeating themselves.
And although it happened 40 years ago, it's extremely relevant today because NASA is on the verge of sending a crewed mission to the moon for the first time in over 50 years. And we're all wondering, have they learned from their mistakes?
NASA is trying to do too much, and that's of great concern to me, especially as we look toward these Artemis missions.
This is The Challenger Legacy, a new season of science fiction from ABC Radio National.
Weekly from Wednesday, January 21st. Follow Science Friction on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.